The church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
It is my hope that this law, while respecting the right of personal liberty, will be used sparingly, that we will respect the life of every citizen with the utmost concern for their spiritual and physical well-being, and that as a society, we will be as vigorous in providing full comfort, hospice, and palliative care to all persons, no matter their status, location, or financial ability, as we are in respecting their right to make this ultimate decision over their own fate of their own free will.
That's Maine Governor Janet Mills talking about a physician-assisted suicide bill she signed into law on Wednesday. Can Governor Mills continue to claim to be against suicide or want to prevent suicide if she's signing into law something that legalizes physician-assisted suicide? Can she cut the pie that thinly? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, June the 14th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Wesley Smith, a columnist for National Review Online, will be joining us to talk about both that Maine law legalizing physician-assisted suicide and a recent New York Magazine column titled, "What Does This False Euthanasia Story Tell Us About the Christian Right?" and Terry Schiavo. A little bit later, Pastor Heath Curtis will be our guest. We'll talk about a new Vatican document on gender theory. Dr. Brad Wilcox, director of the National Marriage Project and professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, will be alongside a little later to talk about the benefits of having a father in the home in advance of Father's Day. Then we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We've got 4 soundbites to play for you. When we played them for you, you can vote for one of them to be Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. You vote by sending us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at IssuesETC. Go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/IssuesETC, or just give us a call when we play Soundbite of the Week, 1-877-623-6943. Joining us to talk about the legalization of physician-assisted suicide in Maine, Wesley Smith, regular guest senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council, columnist for National Review Online, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The War on Humans, and Culture of Death, The Age of Due Harm Medicine. Wesley, welcome back.
Hey, good to talk to you again. I just saw you a few days ago.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming and not only speaking, but spending some time with us at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. It was great.
I enjoyed it thoroughly, and boy, does that church have a big organ.
No doubt about that. Wesley, yeah. I'd like you to react to what we heard there a few moments ago from Maine Governor Janet Mills talking about that physician-assisted suicide bill she signed.
Well, she was just so full of it. Excuse me for being a little blunt. As you said in the introduction, how do you sign an assisted suicide bill, declare it basically, as she said, to be a right, and then say, but I hope this is a right that is used sparingly. What rights are used sparingly? And then this, he says, gives kind of an emotive support for hospice, but there's a huge difference between assisted suicide and hospice. Hospice is about living. Hospice is about helping people who are in a terminal condition live their natural lives to the fullest possible extent through symptom control, spiritual assistance. Guess what? Suicide prevention, if that becomes necessary, social services, and so forth. Assisted suicide is explicitly about being made dead. It is the complete contradiction of the hospice philosophy. And so for her to try to put those into one soundbite is ludicrous and frankly, a false equivalence.
So I guess what I'm curious about is, what does this, Maine is obviously not a very populous state, but what does this tell us about the trend toward the legalization of physician-assisted suicide?
Well, you're seeing in this country, for the most part, the states that have legalized it, Maine is the eighth state that has legalized it by legislation. They tend to be the most liberal states, or perhaps on occasion, like in Colorado, the most libertarian. It tells us that also, I think, that there is a real sense out there of a lack of confidence in doctors and in medicine, a lack of confidence that doctors will be able to care for you properly so that when you are going through a terminal condition, and by the way, the terminal illness limitation is pretty much exclusive in the United States, and it's not meant to be permanent. It's meant to get people used to the idea that killing can be an acceptable answer to human suffering. And since many people suffer for far worse and far longer than people with terminal illnesses, once a society accepts that, then as we've seen in Canada, Belgium, Netherlands, and so forth, euthanasia will expand exponentially. But our society has not yet accepted that, and that's why we're seeing this kind of, well, we just want this tiny little limited right, which isn't true, and of course, logically couldn't stay so limited. But it's a declaration of no confidence in medicine and doctors, and yet we're going to allow the very doctors we don't have confidence in to treat us properly to help kill us. It makes no sense.
Is there any limiting principle? Can someone say, well, I think if someone's terminally ill or some other unique circumstance, is there any limiting principle that says, well, what about the person who's just depressed? What about the person who just is maybe just a morbid person who wants to die?
Right. There really isn't, because when you see the arguments on behalf of assisted suicide, when you see media reports, she died in her own way. Well, doesn't anybody who commits suicide die in their own way? She died at her own time. Well, that's what suicide tends to be about. If the organizing principle of assisted suicide euthanasia is that we can eliminate suffering by eliminating the sufferer, once you accept that concept, and once we say, because there really is no, in these laws that are passed, there's no objective requirement of a particular level of suffering or that the, quote, suffering cannot be otherwise ameliorated. It is always defined as that which is as determined by the person who wants to die. Well, if that's the case, there are, as I mentioned just before, a lot of people, for example, the mentally ill, suffer far more extremely than people with physical conditions. And therefore, you see where this agenda has moved beyond the opening game into general acceptance, such as in the Netherlands and Belgium. Mentally ill people, people with psychiatric conditions who are not otherwise physically ill, are actually brought to hospitals and euthanized. They are then wheeled, say, 20 feet into a surgical suite, and their organs are harvested. And this has been written up in mainstream organ transplant journals celebrating that organs taken from mentally ill people after they were killed were able to be transplanted into other patients successfully. Well, in one of these journal articles, I decided they followed four people who were killed, euthanized. Three had neuromuscular disabilities, so were preying on people's anguish over disability. And the fourth was mentally ill. So I looked deep into the paper about what was the mental illness. I was blown away. Self-harming. So the quote, treatment for self-harming was to kill the patient. It was just an astonishing abandonment, and there was not a hint of criticism in this article in the Organ Transplant Medical Journal.
One last question on that subject. Are you concerned about physician conscience rights when it comes to the future of assisted suicide?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In Canada, they have squashed doctors' conscience rights in Ontario, and this is where it's lethal injection euthanasia, much more than assisted suicide. In fact, the thousands of lethal injection euthanasias have occurred in Canada over the last 3 years, and just a handful of those were assisted suicide, meaning where the patient took the poison. And Ontario's medical college, which is like our medical associations, basically passed an ethical rule saying doctors who are asked to euthanize a patient, if that patient is legally qualified, must kill that patient or must provide what is called an effective referral, by which they mean the doctor finds another doctor that the first doctor knows will kill the patient, therefore making that doctor a complicit person in the homicide, because that is what we're talking about. It's homicide. It's not murder because it's not illegal, but it is homicide. That would make that doctor complicit in the homicide, which for many doctors, let's say an LCMS type Lutheran, would be considered an egregious sin. For Catholic doctors, for Eastern Orthodox doctors, perhaps for Muslim and Orthodox Jewish doctors, would consider a terrible, egregious sin that would have eternal implications. And a court of appeals said, well, gee, if you don't want to euthanize patients, and then they added, if you don't want to abort fetuses, and they added, if you don't want to engage in these various procedures that are now being done on transgenderism, for example, inhibiting normal puberty in children with gender dysphoria, well, then you better find something where you won't be asked to do it or get out of medicine. And then when President Trump, that's authoritarianism in my view, and then when President Trump passed a new regulation, not new laws, but just had the Health and Human Services said, we're going to enforce all conscience protections that are existing in U.S. law. There were 25 laws that have them. Previously, only 3 of those laws had enforcement. They now said, okay, we're going to enforce all the laws. The screaming and howling, it hasn't stopped. It's discrimination. You're going to let people die. So the mainstream media, the medical establishment here in the United States want to kill conscience rights too. Now, with regard to assisted suicide in this country, so far the laws that legalized it had protections for doctors because it was the only way to get those laws through. But those, again, that's a way station. Once it becomes generally accepted, you'll see those laws being, if it that happens, and it's certainly my hope it won't, but if that ever happens, those conscience protections will be obliterated like so much dust. Because one more point, Todd, the issue and the effort is to drive Hippocratic oath believing and pro-life doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals out of medicine.
You have recently written some reaction to the left's version of the Terri Schiavo story. Before we get to the truth, what is the left's version of Terri's story?
Well, there's this myth that has come down in the 14 years since Terri died, that this was an interference of the social right, social conservatives, in an intimate family decision about whether to not force this poor woman, young woman, to stay alive in a severely cognitively incapacitated state. And that it was basically the Bushes and the Republicans and social conservatives who forced this on everybody else. That's the myth, and that's false.
What actually happened?
What actually happened is that Terri's blood family, Bob Schindler, who was her father, Mary, her mother, siblings, including Bobby Schindler, they tried to prevent this dehydration. Michael Schiavo was married to Terri Schiavo. When she had a terrible collapse, which we don't know what the cause was, some kind of a cardiac event, and that cut off blood to her brain, and that's what led to her incapacity. For a while, both the family and Michael worked to try to help Terri, and even to the point of having implants put in her brain to try to help her come out of this severe cognitive incapacity. Eventually, there was a medical malpractice lawsuit filed, and approximately, and this is just off the top of my head, but about $1.5 million came in. Most of it, $300,000 or so, was for Michael's loss of relationship with his wife and consortium and so forth. Most of it was to pay for Terri's care for the rest of her life. That Michael testified through his expert witnesses would have a normal lifespan. As soon as the money was in the bank, a few months thereafter, Michael tried to cut off Terry's antibiotics. And that's when her family first went to kind of, let's call it, legal war with Michael. And they sued. They said, let us be her guardian instead of Michael Schiavo because he's not looking out for her best interests. That case was settled. Michael agreed to have the antibiotics. And then the family made a fateful, bad decision, in my opinion, and I think they would agree, to let Michael continue to be her guardian of her person. Several years later, he then decided after the Cruzan case and other things, and bioethics became more involved in advertising that people could have feeding tubes removed, he decided to have her feeding tube removed and brought litigation to that effect. That started a three-year national agony over what was the proper thing to do for this young woman. Now, the myth is that Michael was this loving husband who was just doing what his wife had asked. In actuality, by the time Terry Schiavo died, Michael was living with another woman. He fathered two children by that woman before Terry died. He was living with her. He called her his fiance. Can you imagine the pillow talk? You know, when you're with a woman and she's having your babies and you're married to another woman. So there was a pronounced conflict of interest there, personal and potentially financial, since because of all that money that was in the bank to pay for Terry's care, Michael would inherit that. A guardian ad litem, which is a person appointed to look out for the interests of the helpless person in such trials, actually wrote an opinion saying we should not pull this feeding tube because Michael has these conflicts of personal conflicts and financial conflicts. The response of that was for Michael's lawyer to file a motion saying this guy's biased because we had a run-in some time ago, and the Judge Greer kicked out the guardian ad litem who had made that decision, but never appointed another guardian ad litem, which actually was against Florida law. I was involved deeply in this case, advocating for the family, writing about it again and again and again, and people can look this stuff up on the internet if they're interested. Over time, Florida passed a law trying to save her life. When that finally was declared unconstitutional, the federal law was passed to try to have the federal courts actually do this kind of a trial de novo, meaning let's look at this again. And this is what they say, that George Bush flew into town and forced himself upon the circumstance. In actuality, Terry's law at the federal level was one of the most bipartisan during George W. Bush's administration. The law came down when Terry was actually being dehydrated to death. There was a feeding tube had been taken out, and she wasn't getting any sustenance. And because Congress was going into recess, it required unanimous consent of the Senate. The Senate gave its unanimous consent. This included senators like Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Tom Harkin of Iowa, who was a very liberal member of the Senate. And he was, by the way, behind the scenes, one of the movers and shakers pushing this bill through the Senate. Harry Reid, who became the majority leader and was also supporting this bill. Every liberal senator, every Senate Democrat, everyone, unanimous consent. One senator could have stopped that bill from going through, and none did. Of the Democrats who voted in the House, 45%, some didn't vote because I said it was recess, but 45% of the House caucus that voted supported Terry's bill. So this was one of the most bipartisan bills during the entire Bush presidency, and yet afterwards it was depicted as just the conservative Republicans. By the way, there were a lot of very liberal people supporting Terry's family and trying to save her life. The disability rights movement was unanimous in its support to try to save Terry's life. Disability rights activists are not conservative, generally speaking. They're not pro-life on abortion, generally speaking. They're not religious in their approach, generally speaking. They tend to be very secular. They stood with the family. Ralph Nader stood with the family. He and I actually issued a press release to decry her dehydration. The religious left, also many of them, stood with Terry's family, including Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson flew to Florida and stood next to Terry's blood family in solidarity in a protest to try to help convince the powers that be to save her life. So this was an issue that tore this country apart, it was not left versus right. There were conservatives who actually supported her dehydration. It was one of those issues that really got to the heart of what it means for our morality. And I'm afraid it was a tipping point, because once she died, slowly over 2 weeks, and by the way, her brother said she was bleeding from the eyes at the end. Once she died slowly, and then people supported it, the idea of the ability to protect patients from dehydration in this country is basically gone. And that happens in all 50 states. In France right now, by the way, there's a case called Vincent Lambert, very strikingly similar to Terry's case, where a wife is versus a family and so forth. And the United Nations has actually stepped in, Committee on Disability, and they have asked, and courts have stopped the dehydration of Vincent Lambert, because they want to investigate whether this is a form of discrimination against people with disabilities, which I submit it is, and we tried to make that case in the Terry case without success, and so we'll see if the Vincent Lambert case has a different result.
With only 30 seconds here, Wesley, if Sarah Jones, author of this recent New York Magazine story about Terry Schiavo, asked you for a follow-up, what would you say to her? 30 seconds.
I'd tell her, please quit writing the myths of things you hear on the leftist media or on the mainstream media. You're a journalist. Go back to the way things were at the time and depict what occurred in that story accurately, not based on subsequent revisionism, which is 180 degrees off kilter.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council, columnist for National Review Online, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The War on Humans, and Culture of Death, The Age of Due Harm Medicine. You can purchase his books and read his columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Wesley, thanks.
Thank you. Good talking with you again.
Pastor Heath Curtis joins us on the other side of the break. We're going to be talking about a new Vatican document on gender theory called Male and Female, He Created Them, and take apart the arguments, both biblical and rational, against gender theory. Stay tuned.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
If you appreciate Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, and Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.